Our topic for today is making machines in our image, Jewish perspectives on artificial intelligence. As you can probably imagine, this is not a topic that has been discussed extensively and exhaustively in the traditional literature. It is a somewhat modern question. Historically, the idea of artificial humans, artificial automata, artificial intelligences does go back a while. Apparently, the ancient Greeks had various writings where they talked about such things. Other cultures, Eastern cultures, talked about it. Throughout the medieval period, we've had occasional discussions about it. Later, certainly as we get to the industrial age, the 18th century, the 19th century, we find a lot more talk about it. And then, of course, in the from the mid-20th century to the 21st century, we have a lot of talk about artificial intelligence. The idea of an artificial intelligence, an artificial human, so to speak, really breaks down into two portions. First is the idea that we can create beings that walk, that move, that can function, that can act kind of like humans, just in terms of what they can do. And then there's the intelligence part, the idea of machines that can think, whether they think from a box on a desk, whether they think in from an android, a humanoid-like form. The ultimate possibility, of course, is to create both, to create something that both looks and appears and acts like a human, as well as thinks like a human. For much of human history, both were considered dreams, technological dreams, dreams of magic, were considered fantasies. The idea that humans could create something that looked and acted like a human was something amazing. The idea that you can create something that would think like a human was amazing. Today, of course, the idea of having humanoid androids, robots that can more or less look and act like humans, is not all that surprising anymore, not all that difficult. Today, the big question is artificial intelligence. They've been working on that for some 60, 70 years, made some progress, but that's really the key issue today, the robotics and technology, servo motors and basic electronics and control boards have advanced to the point where we don't see it as a big deal to have an android in a shopping mall or anywhere else that can C-3PO and the rest of them that can be roughly humanoid and act like a human. Today, what we really want to know is intelligence. Can we create machine intelligence? What is machine intelligence? So we're going to try to approach this question from a number of traditional Jewish sources. Obviously, it'll require some flights of fancy, some imagination to try to apply some of the things that have been said in the Jewish tradition to the modern questions. We're going to look at four or five basic questions. What does Judaism say about philosophically, theologically, the possibility of creating an artificial intelligence? What is the soul? Can we match something that will function more or less like an actual human in terms of intelligence? Is it a good idea? If we can do it, do we worry about harm? How to view the harm? And harm comes in several varieties. Harm comes in the sense of killer robots destroying the world. Harm comes in the sense of economic displacement. Harm comes simply in the sense, even or something in between, the idea that machines can just get too good at what they do, be uncontrollable, even if they're not malevolent, we can lose control, they can do more or behave differently and unexpectedly in ways that we didn't want. As we'll see, all these questions are discussed, or at least alluded to, or we can find some sources that bear on all these basic questions. Just to get one elephant in the room taken care of, or at least acknowledged before we start, one of the great struggles of artificial intelligence in the scientific and academic community for decades has been, what is artificial intelligence? Do we have a definition? Some of the very frustrated pioneers of artificial intelligence decades ago began to get really annoyed every time they would solve some problem, first checkers, then chess, and so on, pattern recognition of various sorts. People would say, that's not real intelligence. You solved that by brute force methods, and that was really trivial. So they coined an expression that artificial intelligence is anything that hasn't been done yet, basically. That any problems that have been solved are relegated to the part of simple rote calculation, machine-like stuff. Anything that hasn't been done yet, that'll be real intelligence until they do it, at which point it will move categories into the that's not real intelligence. So it's very difficult to try to even define what we mean by intelligence. The most famous discussion is a seminal paper by Alan Turing, great mathematician, father of computer science and so on, one of the fathers of computer science, who began his celebrated paper by saying, I propose to consider the question, can machines think? He proposed something, a brilliant idea known as the Turing test. It existed a number of varieties in his paper. He proposed a few. We don't need to concern ourselves with all the subtleties and slight nuances of difference, but basically He proposed doing away with the philosophical question of can machines think, tackling it head on. Instead, he proposed a more functional definition. We will be satisfied that machines can think if a machine can pass itself off as a human to a human interrogator, to a human judge, if he can, you have two of them behind closed doors who submit their responses to questions via printed word, teletype, or a computer screen. If they can act and pass themselves off in a manner that makes them indistinguishable from humans, we'll call that intelligence. Obviously, that's not a fundamental definition, but in the sense of having a somewhat useful standard for establishing what do we mean by intelligence, that was a famous one that's still being discussed today. Can we create machines that pass the Turing test? Obviously, it's a somewhat vague definition. How much time do you get to interrogate? What kind of questions do you ask? And so on. But basically, that's the kind of functional idea that we use. A machine will have passed a major milestone if it can successfully, consistently, or whatever the standards are, portray itself convincingly as a human. As we'll see, actually, one of the key discussions in the Jewish sources is going to be whether the question of speech, communication, by hearing and understanding, communicating verbally, and so on, that is going to be one of the key definitions, the key aspects of intelligence discussed. We will get to that soon. So in the Jewish tradition, the classic discussions about artificial intelligence, or the closest equivalent we have to do with stories of what today would be referred to as golems, although traditionally they were not known as such. They were traditionally entities, beings, men who were created by sages. And there is considerable discussion, well, not considerable discussion, but there is some interesting discussion going back to the Talmud and then proceeding down through halakhic sources of all places, discussing the possibility of creating these things and what status they have in Jewish law. I should have mentioned that's actually, aside from the question of can we do it, what does it mean to be intelligent, what are the upsides and downsides, one of the most interesting questions is, do we consider these things human? If we can construct artificial intelligences, should they be considered human? Should they have rights? This is what Philip K. Dick explored in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, Blade Runner, and the rest of that stuff about, do we consider real artificial intelligences as human? Should they have the rights of humans, the legal rights, the ethical rights to be treated as human? And that's also something that the halakhic traditions discuss. The earliest sources about creating humans, creating humanoid-like entities with some level of intelligence goes back to the Talmud, and we proceed from there to some of the halakhic sources several centuries later. The Talmud has a series of passages, fairly cryptic passages, as you'd expect on a topic like this, but a series of fairly cryptic passages about rabbis in the Talmud creating, again, calls them gavra, simply means a human, creating humanoid entities of some sort. How are they created? The Talmud uses language about the Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah is an ancient mystical book, one of the earliest books we have at all, one of the early in Judaism, one of the earliest mystical books, certainly. Not clear what the book means. It's generally interpreted as a Kabbalistic work about the secrets of creation, the letters of putting together divine names and letters that underlie the rules of creation. So the Talmud says that various rabbis, they got together and they created a man through Sefer Yetzirah, through the mystic knowledge of Sefer Yetzirah. It's actually interesting. If you read the Talmudic text that we have, in one version of the passage, it refers to the Sefer Yetzirah. In another version, it refers to Hilchos Yetzirah, the halachot of Yetzirah. This is a hallmark of Judaism. We approach lots of things through halacha. Halacha is the technical, the meat and the milk, but halacha is, literally means the way, but halacha is often used to refer to, we view everything through the prism of halacha. Rav Soloveitchik famously talks about this, halachic man, how you can view anything, you can view science, you can view the world, you can view philosophy through the prism of halacha. Halacha, on its most basic level, is a very technical set of rules about what you should actually do and don't do. But in Rav Soloveitchik's formulation, certainly the idea of halacha is simply a Jewish perspective on the world in general, and it's noteworthy that the Talmud uses the phrase, the expression Hilchos Yetzirah at one point, the laws of creation, which is also really a very modern way of looking at it. Other cultures may have referred to creating beings by magic, by mysticism, by sorcery. The Talmud refers to doing it by Hilchos Yetzirah, the laws of formation, the laws of creation, a very modern notion that there are underlying laws to creation. If you can understand them and you can penetrate their secrets, then you can almost become God, so to speak. You can do things that involve incredible, mind-boggling things, mind-boggling to the uninitiated, at least. You can create men. So the Talmud relates that Rava, Rava created a man. He sent the man to Rabbi Zeira, one of his rabbinic colleagues. Rabbi Zeira tried to converse with this man, almost like a Turing test, so to speak. He talked to him. The man could not answer. Literally seems to mean he was mute. He couldn't converse at all. Whether he simply physically was incapable of speech or whether he was somehow mentally deficient, we'll get to that soon, whether he simply didn't possess the faculty of rational communication, he was unable to communicate. Rabbi Zeira said, "Oho, I see what you are. You're not a human. You're made by one of us. You're the product of human creation. I see what's going on here. Go back to where you came from. Go back to dust. You know, you be gone, so to speak." And that was the end of him. He terminated him, retired him, in the words of the Blade Runner idiom. But the Talmud says that a man was created. He was somewhat human. He couldn't really converse. And Rav Zeira said, that is it. The Talmud later actually goes so far as to say this is permitted. The Talmud is permitted to do this. The Talmud is discussing kishuv, sorcery. Sorcery, the Torah spends a lot of time prohibiting all forms of the dark arts, necromancy and divination, and sorcery and so on. The Talmud says Sefer Yetzira is okay. Doing magic, wondrous things via the mysteries, the secrets of Sefer Yetzira is okay. That's something that actually is permitted. That is not a problem. There is an amazing passage in the work of the Meiri, Rabbi Menachem Meiri, a 13th, 14th century Provençal scholar, something of a rationalist. He tended to follow Maimonides and many of his scientific and rationalist views. He raises the question, if sorcery is something that the Torah completely prohibits, the Torah is completely opposed to sorcery, why is white magic, so to speak, Sefer Yetzirah magic, any better? Black magic is a problem and different kinds of magic is okay. What's that all about? Why is that any different? And he says something, you know, truly amazing. He says the Sefer Yetzirah, whatever they were doing there, was not actually magic. It was actually what we would call technology. He says the idea of the Sefer Yetzirah, it teaches mysteries and secrets of the universe. He says scientists themselves, scholars of nature, Chachmei HaTeva, will tell you that with enough science, with enough understanding of the natural world, creating humans is not impossible. Therefore, he says, those who study the Sefer Yetzirah, those who understand the cosmos on some deep level, will be able to create humanoids, he says, to create different types of animal or human life other than through the normal means, via sexual reproduction, he says. This is certainly possible, he says, and that's why it's not sorcery. Technology is technology, sorcery is sorcery. The end results might be very similar. Arthur C. Clarke famously said this, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. There are all kinds of corollaries to that. Some of the pro-technology people like to rephrase that as any technology that is still distinguishable from magic is insufficiently advanced. But the point is, the Meiri is essentially making this point that sufficiently advanced technology to the observer, to the untrained observer, seems wonderful and even magical, but it's not. From a halakhic perspective, there is a clear difference. Magic is something the Torah prohibits. Whether magic really exists, whether it's fraud, whatever it is, magic is something which is prohibited. Technology is not. Therefore, he says that this whole idea of creating beings via the Sefer Yetzirah is something that is okay. It is not prohibited. And so the Meiri is already anticipating the idea that by using advanced technology, we could create entities that can be somewhat human and maybe even have some intelligence like human beings. Rav Asher Weiss, a leading contemporary thinker, a leading halachist, leading thinker in many areas of Jewish thought, is baffled, and he's very unhappy with these comments of the Meiri. He says that, how can that be? He just takes it as given, a priori impossible, that humans could possibly create creation ex nihilo, yesh me'ayin, something out of nothing, he says. He quotes a Ramban to that effect. He quotes an interesting midrash. The Midrash is going on the phrase in the beginning of Parashas Lech Lecha. It says that when God told Abraham and Sarah to leave Haran and make their way to Eretz Canaan, so it says they went and they took Es HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Haran. They took the souls that they had made in Haran. So made, Asher Asu, that they made is an interesting idiom. How do you make souls? So the simple reading, which is the Midrash's conclusion, is that made means they taught them, they developed them into religious personalities, they civilized them, that they had fashioned them in the image of an upright, God-fearing person. And that's the Midrash's conclusion. But the Midrash tries to illustrate the impossibility, the absurdity of taking the words literally at face value. It says, even if we were to, even for everyone in the world, all the technology, all the resources you want, all the scholarship in the world would gather to try to make even the tiniest gnat, they would be unable to. It is axiomatic. Man cannot create even gnat, certainly not man. So certainly, Asher Asu Bacharan cannot mean literally they made, and therefore it means, as we said, they taught, they formed, morally. So Rav Weiss concludes, it's the Meiri is impossible, he says, it's incredible, humans cannot, Rav Weiss is a contemporary, he's alive today, he's humans cannot create anything, not even create gnats, they certainly can't create other humans. Out of the question, he says, Meiri's comments are just incredible, he says, he cannot accept what the Meiri says. The truth is, Rav Weiss is kind of conflating, really, I think, two separate issues. One of them, he refers to creation ex nihilo, creating something from nothing, which even today we recognize pretty much violates the laws of thermodynamics and you know, quantum physics says some pretty strange things, but in general we say that you can't create something out of nothing. That's something that certainly AI researchers have no pretensions to do, that they're not interested in that, that's not their goal. Their goal, of course, is to work with resources, to work with metal and wood and plastic and silicon, and simply to create machines or as abstractions in mathematical constructs that can reason. That has nothing to do with creatio ex nihilo. The other question, certainly what the Midrash says, we can't even create gnats. That's not intelligence. Gnats do not have intelligence in any interesting sense of the word, at least not the major ones we're interested in. The Midrash seems to be referring to either imbuing it with any life force, let alone intelligence. And that's certainly something that we can certainly create something that is fairly lifelike. I remember when I studied high school biology, so even defining life is a pretty tough thing to do. They used to, again, define life, at least when I was in school, they used to define life in a fairly, again, a fairly functional manner, similar to Turing. They would say life consists of beings that do the following 8 or 10 or 12 functions, locomotion and reproduction and digestion and respiration and whatnot. So again, certainly we can create simple robotics to get artificial intelligence. We can certainly create robotic entities that perform any of those functions. Locomotion has been a solved problem for years and years. We can do many of those things, forms of digestion, and we can process organic material, we can chemically do things to it. So certainly creating gnats in the sense of the little flying whiz bugs that go around and do stuff is not a particularly difficult problem. You can talk about some abstract, irreducible, mystic notion of life, but again, we don't have a definition even for what that is if mechanical constructs don't really satisfy it. But the key question, again, is intelligence. Rav Weiss is claiming that it's incredible to him, the notion that we can create life or intelligence. But again, the Meiri seems to be saying we can, and certainly there doesn't seem to be any definitive, any authoritative Torah source that absolutely, compellingly indicates that we can't. Meiri seems to be saying that we can. That's actually how he understands these Talmudic passages, and that's key to his understanding. That's why it's not a prohibited form of sorcery, because it's not magic, it's actually technology. While Rav Weiss seems to consider it axiomatic that such a thing is impossible. That actually brings us to another... He's arguing that you cannot possibly interpret the Talmud to mean that they created beings via technology, which seems to be, he doesn't seem to be making a claim about modern technology. He seems to be basing himself on Midrashim and Torah sources, that it's reserved for God, the Ramban's languages, Hakol Shelo, Hakol Biyado, that it's reserved for God, that God reserves the power to create life for himself, and humanity fundamentally can't do it. I can't tell you exactly what Rav Weiss holds, but that the way he writes it, he seems to think it's fundamentally... permanently impossible. So again, we get to another one of Arthur C. Clarke's laws. He was famous as a futurist. He was a great science fiction writer, but many of his predictions have actually come true, and he was famous for an acute understanding of the development of science. And he wrote that when a distinguished scientist says something is possible, he's almost certainly right. When he says something is impossible, he's very probably wrong. Again, you have to be careful when you say things are impossible, because many things that certainly our parents or grandparents would have considered inconceivable or impossible today are commonplace. Phones, and smartphones, and computers, and so on. And you always have to be very careful. Clark's point is certainly correct. You always have to be very careful before you state on absolutist, dogmatic ground something is impossible. Famously, I think they say, before the Wright brothers developed flight, there were distinguished scientists who had demonstrated that heavier-than-air flight is an engineering impossibility. So you always have to be very careful before you declare things impossible. So this is the Talmudic background. We have various rabbis who created entities, a humanoid entity, another Reb Zeira who terminated one. They may have done it by some kind of divine magic, say for Yetzirah in its normally understood sense. They may have done it via technology. And Rabbi Yehuda terminated it. He apparently had no ethical qualms with terminating such an entity. We'll discuss in our next group of sources, we'll discuss whether this would constitute murder to terminate such an entity, why or why not, as well as what such entity status are for the purposes of halacha, which will give us more insight about what level of intelligence these beings are presumed to have, and so on. So today, when we think of the Jewish tradition and humanoid, semi-autonomous entities that walk around and do stuff, we think of golems, we call them. The most famous one is the one that is ascribed to the Maral of Prague, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague. The Maral almost certainly did not create any golem. In our generation, Schneer Lyman, Professor Schneer Lyman, has written extensively on this. He actually is diplomatic and careful, and he studiously avoids discussing whether the Maral actually did or did not create a golem. He simply says things like, the evidence presented by various people range from forgeries to misunderstandings to inapplicable or irrelevant sources. But basically, the way the story goes, the Maral's golem is the famous one. It was the product of a work published about a century and a half ago, Rabbi Rosenberg, who published this novelistic account of the life and times of the Maral's golem, an entity he created to help the oppressed Jews push back and defend themselves against some of the depredations of the anti-Semitic Christian host cultures, various adventures that the golem has had. Rabbi Rosenberg's work is generally believed to be a literary fabrication. He may have meant it as literature, Lyman suggests. He may not, but whatever it is, it's generally believed to be a fabrication. He gives details about how he found it and who wrote it and how it got to him, which are either demonstrably false or highly implausible. There are no early sources for the Maral's golem. Historians have played a little game of trying to trace back exactly how far back the earliest recorded sources of the Maral's golem go. You can actually go back as early as about 1835. Given that the Maral lived in the 16th century, that's not really good enough to be a credible source. They appear in various German and European works, Jewish works, in the early to mid 19th century. Not quite good enough. Moreover, Lyman points out, there are various other, much more authentic sources, eminently respectable Jewish sources that do discuss golems. We're about to discuss a few of them. And they know nothing about the Maral. They discuss other rabbis who may have created golems. They even discuss other miracle stories about the Maral, none of which involve golems. So it's almost certain that the Maral did not create a golem. However, there were traditions that were recorded by some of the most distinguished rabbinic leaders of the generation about golems that were created. None of these are firsthand accounts, but they were traditions that they felt worthy of preserving for posterity. The two famous accounts are one by Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi and his son, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who both discuss a family lore about an ancestor of theirs who had fashioned, they don't use the word golem, they talk about who created a man in the style of the Talmudic account of someone who created a man and a venerable ancestor of theirs, unclear who the person is exactly, but who created some kind of semi-autonomous humanoid figure. And they both discuss both the halacha of this as well as what this means, what he actually was, and so on. Rav Tzvi Ashkenazi, the father, the Chacham Tzvi, as he's known, discusses this. He says his ancestor, the Gaon Reb Elio, chief rabbi, chief of the rabbinical court of Chelm, he made a man, fashioned a man. So Rav Ashkenazi's first question is, as a Jew, as halachic man, in Rav Salvechik parlance is, can you count him for a minion? So what's the question? How do you unpack such a question? One question, obviously, is he Jewish? You know, is he human, first of all? And if he is human, is he the subset of humanity considered Jewish? Third question, is he considered intelligent? So we require to be part of a minion, you can't be mentally deficient beyond a certain point. You can't be considered insane. So the question is, these are the three questions. Is he human? Is he mentally competent? Is he Jewish? Rav Ashkenazi says some remarkable things in the course of his analysis. He says, is he Jewish? On the one hand, he says he isn't actually a descendant of Jews, which is usually how we define Jewish. On the other hand, he says there is a celebrated statement in the Talmud. One who raises an orphan, one who adopts a child, essentially. One who adopts a child, raises him, and develops him into a human being, into an adult, into a Jew, is considered as though he has given birth to him, as though he has fathered him, as though he has mothered him, and so on. Says the Chacham Tzvi, if you create the golem, he's the product of the handiwork of the righteous. Maybe he's considered Jewish because you made him. You don't have to make him in the ordinary sexual reproduction sense. You make him using other means. That is perhaps good enough. This was an earlier foreshadowing of a famous position of Rav Shlomo Kluger, writing a century or two later. Rav Ashkenazi was in the 18th century, 17th, 18th century. Rav Shlomo Kluger in the 19th century talked about the question of whether one fulfills the biblical obligation of pru revu, to have children by adopting a child, and he actually suggests yes, because ki'ilu yaldo, the Talmud says, by raising a child, it's as though you have actually given birth to him, as though you have sired him. So Rav Kluger actually suggests that adoption fulfills the mitzvah. Many posts can disagree, he himself is not sure, but Rav Ashkenazi is saying something similar. Even a golem, even something that you simply make using, again, magic or technology, even that is considered human and Jewish, because you made him. He and his son, Rav Emden, then they vacillate on this one again. They go back and forth. They bring from various Kabbalistic sources. Rav Ashkenazi brings from the Sefer Pardes Rimonim, a noted 16th century Kabbalistic work of Rav Moshe Cordovero, who says that the man that was created by Rava in the Talmud did not have the various portions of the soul. In Kabbalistic thought, we break down the soul into nefesh, ruach, neshama, different words for soul, different parts of the soul. He had none of those. All he had was simple chiyus, simple life. So we distinguish between basic life, the basic, basically being alive versus the soul, which is a higher order level of life or being human. And these Kabbalistic sources say that this entity that Rava created was not really human, and therefore certainly he could not count toward a minion. They actually discuss why Rabbi Zeira was allowed to kill this person. Killing a human is called murder. Rav Emden actually brings, again, based on Kabbalistic sources, he was not really human. That's why there was no prohibition of murder. The same way turning off a computer is not murder. So turning off a created humanoid entity is not murder. So they go back and forth on whether you can actually count such an entity, whether you could count him for a minion. In the course of his discussion, Rav Ashkenazi makes a very curious, very odd argument. He says, I'll prove to you that a created entity of these sorts does not count for a minion, because Rav Zeira terminated him with extreme prejudice, with no qualms about just getting rid of him. If he can count for a minion, that's a useful thing. You need a minion sometimes, so why wouldn't you have kept him around to use him for a minion? I was talking to a friend of mine last night about the idea of created artificial entities being used for a minion. So he told me, that would be great. You know, when you need a minion, you could just manufacture people. That would give a whole new meaning, he said, to the jargon, the term minion factory. Minion factory today is used to mean a place that has lots of minyanim, regular like clockwork. Whole new idea of minion factory. It's a Sefer Yetzirah, technology, creates some humanoid entities. But Rav Ashkenazi says if he was useful for a minion, he wouldn't have terminated him. It's a very hard argument to swallow. And if he wasn't useful for a minion, there was nothing else he was useful for. Presumably he had other uses. And if he didn't have other uses, I mean, you can make more people for a minion. It doesn't seem like the question of whether you should destroy an artificial intelligence should hinge entirely on the question of whether you could count him for a minion or not. Presumably Rav Ashkenazi meant that he was using the idea of minion as a proxy for much deeper questions of, is he really human for halakhic purposes, for other purposes? And if he is, then you shouldn't destroy him. Maybe it's morally wrong. Maybe it's not a smart thing to do. It's not effective. It's not efficient to just destroy humanoid-like things for no reason. But be that as it may, Rav Ashkenazi argued that there would be no reason to destroy him if he was human enough to count for a minion. Now, another counter-argument, though, to Rav Ashkenazi's suggestion, putting aside the question of maybe there are other things you can do with him, was an objection raised by the Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, as well as other people. They pointed out the idea of artificial intelligence is there's a downside, there's a dark side. They can be pretty dangerous. As a matter of fact, Rav Yaakov Emden himself, the son, in his own discussion of this question of counting him for a minion, he says, by the way, you want to know the rest of the story, he says, what happened? What was the ultimate fate of this being created by our ancestor? So my father, he says, Rav Ashkenazi told me the following tale of how this automaton met his end. He says that this thing was growing and getting larger and larger. He thought it would destroy the whole universe. He removed the holy name that was embedded in his forehead. That caused him to disintegrate and return to dust. According to one version of the story, he has the word Emes on his forehead. We take off the Aleph, it turns into Mace, which means dead. Rav Emden doesn't get into details of how to do this exactly, what the kill switch is. Precisely, he just says, you remove a divine name, and he disintegrates. But he was apparently a pretty dangerous thing. While he was engaged in extracting the holy name, the golem injured him and scarred him on the face. This is something, both these motifs, the idea that golems, artificial entities can get pretty dangerous, was a common motif starting from the 18th century. Certainly, it's in the news every day these days. When I was younger, I think I watched Disney's Fantasia, the sorcerer's apprentice of Mickey Mouse, who learns the sorcerer's secrets and enchants some brooms to help him with his chores. The problem is he doesn't know how to stop or turn it off, so they keep on going. He chops up the brooms, they multiply, now there are more brooms, they keep on going and going and filling up the whole room until the room is filled with water, until finally the older, wiser person who actually knows what he's doing puts a stop to it. This is actually, you live and learn, the internet knows many wonderful things, tells us that this is actually based on a poem by Goethe, the German poet. I reproduced it here for your edification. Not going to read the whole thing, but the basic tale goes back again to the 18th or early 19th century, and many of the stories, whether Frankenstein or many of the other stories of artificial intelligences, magic intelligences of various sorts, deal with this potential pitfall. They can become a little too good, they're a little too good at what they do. You can let the genie out of the bottle, so to speak. You can start him, but you can't stop him. And it's something which is a dangerous thing to do, to have, like Pope said, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. You can have enough knowledge to get it started, not enough knowledge to get it to stop. And that's one version of the danger of artificial intelligences. And indeed, getting back to the Chidar of Azulai, he says, maybe that's why Rav Zeira destroyed this thing, that you want to nip it in the bud. These things can easily get out of control. They can cause more harm than good. And this is already a strain of thought that discusses the dark side of artificial intelligences, the idea, even if they're not explicitly malevolent, they can simply get out of your control. They can be much easier to start than to stop. And today, certainly, we deal with killer. Rabbi Winter just showed me the latest article about war systems, military systems, killer AI. Every day we hear about a fight with Google about its employees staging an insurrection because they're supporting who knows what kind of nefarious project for the government. Apparently, one of the most famous movie quotes of all time is HAL 9000 telling Dave Bowman, "Open the pod bay doors, Hal. I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that." But condemning him to die out there. So yeah, the danger of artificial intelligence is going wrong, going rogue, either getting out of control or certainly becoming malevolent is something that was long recognized in thought in general, Jewish thought, non-Jewish thought, and the Jewish versions are we have the Chidah, we have other Achronim who say that was perhaps why, that was why Rav Zeira felt the need to put an end to Rava's little experiment. And in the case of the golem discussed by Rav Ashkenazi and Rav Emden, that he actually did begin to get out of control. He did begin to become overweening and overpowering, and even in stopping him, his creator was actually injured, was permanently scarred by trying to shut off the golem. I want to spend a few minutes, the remainder of our time, just discussing the economic question, which is, will they replace humans? Will they take away jobs? They have been taking away jobs for years. Will they, even more than that, existentially, will they deprive human life of all meaning? There's nothing we can do to contribute anymore. They'll do everything, and what will we do with ourselves? So these basic questions have gone back primarily to the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution. We have the Luddite movement. Today, a Luddite is just a pejorative term for people who don't like technology. Back then, there was actually a guy called Ned Ludd, and he was involved with the movement. It involved things like weavers or tailors whose jobs were being taken away by the mechanization of textile production, looms, and other type of equipment. They used to go around smashing the equipment. And this became a major debate in the 19th century, and it goes on till today. We read about technology taking away all kinds of jobs. They used to be the blue-collar jobs, the robots and the machines. Now they're coming for the white-collar jobs, the radiologists and the lawyers and so on. So this has obviously been a hot topic for a couple of centuries already. again, the halacha considers this from a halachic perspective, and this actually comes up, of all places, the classic Jewish discussion of this comes up in the context of matzah for Pesach. In the 19th century, they began to develop machines for making matzahs. The machine matzah is quite common today. Many people, maybe most people who eat matzah today, eat machine matzah. Machine matzah is a lot cheaper. You can produce it. It's a much more cost-effective way of making matzah, and therefore the question arises, much the same as textile workers. You are displacing workers who otherwise made their living, made a significant amount of parnassa, making matzah by hand, the old-fashioned way. So when they first developed machine matzah, again, machine matzahs then were not electric-powered industrial things like today. They were simply, you know, gears and cogs and levers, but they were labor-saving. They were more effective. And in the 19th century, there was a tremendous argument, a tremendous debate about machine matzah. Most of the debate had to do with ritual questions, are the matzahs kosher, for a variety of reasons. But the great opponent of machine matzah was Rav Shlomo Kluger, a towering figure, mentioned him briefly earlier, a towering figure in 19th century halacha. Rav Shlomo Kluger had a number of reasons why he was opposed to machine matzah. Many of his reasons, again, were technical objections related to the kashrus of the matzah. But one reason, and according to some, that was his primary reason, one reason he was opposed to machine matzah, he felt it would be unfair. He had compassion for the poor laborers who made significant money making matzah. He felt it would be unfair, it would hurt their parnasse in a way that was unfair. He said that, he has a biting comment, he said it's bad enough if we would give the proper tzedakah, if we would give Moes Chitim, the charity that's customarily given to the poor to help them make Pesach. We're not even giving that. At least, he says, let's give them the jobs. Let's at least give them the compensation, the salary that they get for making matzah. We're going to take even that away from them, he says. That's completely unfair. So one of his reasons for opposing machine matzahs, perhaps his primary reason, was economics, was a Luddite notion that mechanization is taking away jobs. It's not fair to those who depend on those jobs. Many other leading rabbinic figures disagreed with Rav Kluger. So again, most of their arguing back and forth was about the technical laws of matzah. But they did respond to this argument, too, about the technology displacing labor. We find Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, another towering figure, Galicia, of that period, was very upset at Rav Kluger. He felt the argument got very bitter and very personal very quickly. He has a kind of biting, savage rejoinder to Rav Shlomo Kluger. He says, really? He says, you want to prohibit machine matzah because it's not fair to the workers? Well, I have some more inventions you can ban. Let's ban the industrial printing press, he says. You're taking away jobs from the poor printers. You used to do everything by hand, he says. And maybe, Rav Kluger, maybe you've published books sometimes by industrial printing. Maybe that's a terrible thing. He says, how come only when it comes to machine matzah are we so worried about the machines taking away jobs from the poor? Another argument we find is another economic counter argument is that what most economists will tell you and have been telling you from the 19th century is that technology, increasing efficiency, what they call productivity today, is a good thing. The GDP, the net economic product, is good. Having more stuff is, from an economic perspective, good. Now, you worried about distribution. You worried about the workers. It's not what they call a Pareto improvement. Not everyone gains. Some people lose. Even if the net result is a gain, some people lose. So we can fix that. That's a solvable problem. Either distribute some money via taxation or worker retraining programs. But to an economist who's juggling the numbers, clearly having more stuff has to be better than having less stuff. And if you're worried that the more stuff are not going to the right people, let's fix that. We'll still be better off than having less stuff all around. So that was always the answer to the Luddites. That was always the answer of mainstream economics to people who wanted to artificially limit the domestic product by banning technology. And we find that argument raised in response to Rav Shlomo Kluger too. We find that raised by another authority at the time, Rav Mordechai Landau. He tells Rav Kluger, he says, I don't understand. He says that you want to give tzedakah, give tzedakah, he says. And also he says, if you have machine matzah, they're cheaper, so the consumers benefit. So somebody benefits, he says. So at the end of the day, having cheaper stuff is, the economic arguments will generally indicate that having cheaper stuff, the benefit from cheaper production outweighs the loss of the job. And you're worried about, but it doesn't balance because it doesn't help if you're the one who lost his job, that your neighbor can spend 10% less on an iPhone, but you've lost your job. That's a solvable problem. We can somehow redistribute the money. Now, the obvious problem with this approach is that, in theory, In textbook academic economics, yes, that is true. That in an ideal world, if we can run the economy based on economic theory, that would be a great idea. In practice, there are political parties, there are constituencies, there are political ads, there's journalism. And in the real world, you can simply say, no problem, more GDP is obviously better. Let's just shuffle some counters around, write some equations. Real world, it doesn't work. Things are sticky. Job training is not so easy. People are not just chess pieces that can be shuffled around to move to different parts of the country where the new jobs are available. In the real world, the fact is there very much are real losers in addition to the winners. So the question is really a very real question. The question that Rav Shlomo Kluger raises is, do you have the right to do this, to benefit some of society, much of society, in, let's say, a more marginal way? They can save a few percent, or they can save on some of their consumer products at the expense of destroying the livelihoods and the self-respect and the dignity of those who are losing their jobs. That's a question we still don't have an answer to, obviously. And obviously, depends on the details. The technology is accelerating at a rate that it was not accelerating before. Obviously, to compare specific 19th century examples to 20th century cases, 21st century cases, is difficult, but at least to look at the fundamental concepts that Jewish thought has used to analyze these questions, these are the cases we would start with, and the question then is trying to apply these rules to the modern questions that we face in the 21st century.